This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. What values define us as Americans? What values define us as a country? The dean of the Woodrow Wilson at Princeton, Anne-Marie Slaughter, identifies them as liberty, democracy, equality, justice, tolerance, humility, and faith. She says these values need to guide our actions not only here at home, but also abroad. She says they must inform our foreign policy. In her words, American patriotism is grounded not only in our love for our country itself, but also in our love for the values our country stands for, of the idea that is America, no matter how far short we may fall in practice. Dean Slaughter's latest book is entitled The Idea That Is America, Keeping Faith with Our Values in a Dangerous World. Listeners, you're invited to join the discussion this afternoon with a phone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Anne-Marie Slaughter's most recent book, The Idea That Is America, Keeping Faith with Our Values in a Dangerous World, is published by Basic Books. You can learn more about our guest and the book at the website www.ideathatisamerica.com. And again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Anne-Marie Slaughter, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. I'm delighted to be on. My aunt taught at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana for 40 years, so
How
I know
terrific.
It well.
Very good. Well, now let's talk about the idea that is America. Why did you write this book?
I wrote this book because I felt very strongly that America had essentially lost its way in the world. And I came to that view traveling across the country and traveling around the world. In 2004, after the Abu Ghraib pictures were revealed, and with the Iraq War generally, when I would travel around the world, people would come up to me and say, you know, what's happened to your country? You don't stand for what you used to stand for. You're out there advocating torture and telling other people you don't have to play by the same rules. And we just don't recognize your country anymore. I've always been proud to be an American. I'm half Belgian, but I'm 100% American, and I've always been willing to take criticism, but able to stand up for what we stood for, and I had a hard time. And then when I would travel in the United States, in the Midwest and in the South and in the West, I would often get the question, what role should we be playing in the world? We're not sure what we should be doing in the world. We feel like we're under threat, and we want to defend ourselves, but does that mean we have to compromise our values? So this book was a very personal effort to try to go back to what I think of as our founding values and use them to put us back on course. Mm.
There are a couple of people who, it seems, played a big role in inspiring this book or inspiring your thinking about the idea that is America. One, a journalist, William Harlan Hale. The other, a soldier, Ian Fishback. And it was a letter from Fishback to Senator John McCain, in fact, that inspired the title of the book. Tell us about these two figures and how their words have made an impact on you.
Absolutely. Well, let me start with Captain Fishback, because I read his letter, which was written in the spring of 2005, so it was a year after the first revelations of Abu Ghraib had come out. And I was already writing the book, but I read this letter in the Washington Post, and it's from, you know, a soldier, a guy who was educated at West Point, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, who had tried every way he knew to get clear interrogation rules from his superiors. And he said, you know, unless we get clear interrogation rules, we're going to see horrible abuses. We've already seen them. And he gets nowhere. So he finally writes to McCain. So it's one military man writing to another. And, of course, McCain had been a prisoner of war himself. And he ends his letter, and his letter's all about having to not compromise our values when we're under threat. And he said, I'd rather die fighting than sacrifice even the smallest part of the idea that is America. And I thought, here's somebody who's under fire fighting for our values and yet is saying we can't compromise those values. It is a false choice to think that we will enhance our security by compromising those values. And that is what gave me the idea for the book. I mean, his notion that he was fighting not just for a people or a country, but for an idea. And William Harlan Hale, I was browsing this bookstore in L.A., and I was actually looking for Americana, you know, for ballads and poems and anything I could that would help me in my research. And I come across this dusty black book, and the title is The March of Freedom, A Layman's History of the United States. And I open it up, and it was written in 1947 by this guy, William Harlan Hale, who turns out to be a classicist from Yale, who was a broadcaster for the Voice of America. He was a critic. He'd done a lot of different things, and it turns out he was actually an advisor to Harry Truman, but I didn't know that. But he says, and this is 1947, he said, you know, I don't recognize my country. We're getting criticized for being an imperialist. We are crisscrossed by political divisions. We are apathetic. And this is not the country that I know and love. And I'm going to go back to our past to find the way to set us back on track. And it was exactly the feelings that I was having in 2007 or 2004 through 2007. And he then described his own vision of what America was supposed to be. And I won't go into the full description here, but he does describe being with American soldiers when they liberated Dachau, and he describes a ceremony at which the American soldiers carried the American flag, and instead of putting it above all the other nations' flags, you know, high on a raised podium, they put it next to all the other nations' flags. And he uses that as a symbol of how he sees America in the world. And it's a very accurate description of how I see America in the world.
Mm. Anne Marie Slaughter, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, her latest book, The Idea That Is America, Keeping Faith with Our Values in a Dangerous World. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Before we go any further, I think your audience has the right to know that Slaughter here fully supported the Bush war of aggression against Iraq in order to promote her own career with the Bush administration. This war has now killed 3,644 American service members.
Is this Francis Boyle?
They are our brothers and our sisters, our mothers and our fathers, our sons and our daughters. And she has their blood on her hands, as well as the blood of a million Iraqis.
Excuse me. We're going to let the guest respond.
I did not support the Bush war the way the Bush administration fought it. I strongly supported and still do support that we should have gone to the United Nations for a second resolution. We should have actually gone to war, if we were going to war, with the authorization of at least a substantial part of the international community. I thought the Bush administration was actually going to go to the UN for a second resolution. After the administration did not, I wrote an op-ed, and I think this is to what the listener, the questioner is referring, that said this war was illegal. I still believe it was illegal. And I said it was illegal, but it is potentially legitimate. And what I wrote was, if, in fact, there are weapons of mass destruction, and if the Iraqis greet us as liberators, and if we go back to the United Nations immediately after the invasion, if those three conditions are satisfied, then long-term people may look back and see, as they said about Kosovo, that although it was illegal, because our invasion of Kosovo is illegal also, it was legitimate. That was my statement. I stand by it now. I think if we had found those things, if we'd found weapons of mass destruction, most importantly, the war would have been seen as legitimate if we had gone back to the UN, if, in fact, we'd been greeted as liberators. None of those three things happened, and I have I'm since on record on having written that since those three things didn't happen, the war was both illegal and illegitimate.
Okay, and I'm going to let the listener in back for a follow-up. But I want this to be a common, civilized conversation here this afternoon, and then I'm going to go on to another caller. Professor Boyle, you want to come back? No, he's gone. Okay. Well, let's move on. Before I go to this next caller, what's your view on what we should be doing in keeping with our values today in terms of what we do about our situation in Iraq?
The first thing we should do is practice the value of humility, which is always the value that people say, wait a minute, I buy the others, but humility, and I make the argument that humility is a great part of our tradition, and our greatest leaders have been willing to openly admit mistakes. And the first thing I would do with Iraq is to say, look, we were wrong. We were fundamentally wrong on some very key issues, weapons of mass destruction, the notion that we could do this with the troops that we had. We betrayed the Iraqi people by not having enough troops to provide them with basic security and letting their country be looted, and of course then creating the or enabling. We didn't create it, but we enabled the chaos that they find themselves in today. I would be very open about our real failures, and then I would turn around and say, okay, we acknowledge that, but now the task is to go forward with as many other countries as possible. I would develop a plan for withdrawal that goes hand in hand with a regional conference to stabilize the politics. That is very similar to the recommendations of the Iraq Commission, the Baker Hamilton Commission, and in fact, I think we may be moving in that direction. But I would also make sure as we pull out that we are not leaving a situation that means we or others are going to have to go back in very soon. So how we get out is as important as we should be as careful getting out as we should have been, but we're not on getting in.
Let's take another call. A listener in Geneva, Illinois, line four. Hi.
Good afternoon. You know what? I'm not defending or you know, supporting anything or any one group. But I'll tell you this: that gentleman that called in there is a good example of what America's turned into. We're a bunch of hate mongers. We hate every military person out there. We think, but I've got friends of mine that are in the military. You may not like the war, but you darn well better not dump on these guys who are out there hanging their butts on the line every day. And I'm tired of hearing people like him call people like yourself and not be humane about it. You know, it's emotional. You know, there's a lot of people who have died out there and gotten maimed, and there's a lot of screw-ups that the government has done. I personally, and I was just wondering, do you think this is more of a political war versus you know, the real kind of war, kind of like a Vietnam? Because I'm looking at it like it is. And I think that's the reason why we're having so many problems out there, because the politicians have got their hands in it.
Well, I want to thank you for your question, because I couldn't agree more with you in terms of changing the tone of politics in this country. One of a lot of publishers turned this book down because it wasn't partisan enough, because it actually has good things to say about Republicans and Democrats, although it has sharp criticisms also. And in terms of our military, one of the things that animated this book for me is I think if we are asking people to die for our values, then we have to be living up for our values. And if we're not living up to our values, we are letting them down. And they didn't ask to be in this war. And their leaders said that they needed double the troop strength, and our politicians did not listen to them, and we owe them a debt. And I think the individual soldiers, by and large, really do think that they are fighting for not just for oil or for American interests, but to first liberate a country from a tyrant and then to create democracy. Unfortunately, and this goes to your second point, the politics of this are such that I don't think they really have a fighting chance. We didn't send in enough troops to begin with. We allow, because of that, we let insurgencies grow that now mean, you know, we are fighting the kind of war that will take 9 or 10 years to win successfully, and that's what General Petraeus says, and yet our political process at home is not going to stand for our having troops there that long, and I understand that too. I understand why the American people says, look, we were misled into this war and now we want out. But the result is it leaves our military, and sadly and tragically, millions of Iraqis in an absolutely horrific situation.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for his call. I'm going to take another call now from a listener in Champaign County, Line 1. Hi.
Hi. There's a lot said about Kosovo as an example of an illegal but eventually legitimate intervention. I just suggest Chomsky's book, Humanitarian Intervention, Lessons from Kosovo, to get really what happened, it seems to me. It's the documentary record that's very infrequently examined. And look what we just have in the news about Kosovo. You know, there's still no solution on Kosovo. The Balkans are even more Balkanized than it was after this than it was before. The so-called Benelux solution or integration that's all used to be talked about as a solution for the Middle East, you know, sort of an integration of the economy is even further away in the Balkans than it was. What did it do? It didn't. You know, bombing civilians is just thrown more gasoline on the fire, so they don't just hate each other. They hate us, too. It boggles the mind, and I associate myself with Francis Boyle's remarks. I mean, it may be a little off the scale in emotion, but one can be very, very angry about this, and to hear liberals justifying Kosovo is just exasperating. When you just have to look at the headlines, you don't even have to read the book on it.
Well, I appreciate the question, and you are right. There's a lot that's still wrong with Kosovo, but I would just squarely disagree with you. I actually think that although there was no solution that was going to create peace and harmony and love in that part of the world, certainly in within the space of one generation, I think the NATO intervention in Kosovo, for all its problems and for all its faults, still resulted in a far better situation today than we would have had if we had simply let Milosevic do what he did in Bosnia and in Croatia. He was ethnic cleansing. We saw him massacre hundreds of thousands of people. We saw him moving people out. He was moving to do that in Kosovo, and the proof is we are enormously popular in Kosovo. The problem today is there's still great power politics involved. Russia does not want Kosovo to be independent. We in the European Union do. Russia has a veto, so we are having to broker a solution, and it's going to be a long-term answer to this problem. It's going to take 20, 30 years. Ultimately, I don't think you're going to get the kind of peace and decent living standards in that country until they've joined the European Union, but that is at least a prospect today. And if we hadn't taken action, Milosevic could still be in power, and he could have ethnically cleansed an entire province.
Go ahead.
I don't see that as a fair. That's a false dichotomy. It isn't a choice between letting him go rampage and starting bombing. There are definitely other strategies that could have been used, but it was clear that the U.S. wanted. Now we have Camp Bondsteel that Halliburton built, as part of our lily pad around the Middle East in the area. I mean, it's just people can just Google that and look at what Chalmers Johnson has written about it and the bases around the world. People need to realize that we are not a disinterested party that is just trying to help the Europeans out in their regional problem. We have a lot of the U.S. and these planners, particularly the Bush administration, but even some of the Democrats, have this idea of maintaining the Pax Americana about world oil. And I'm not calling for a non-cooperative role of the U.S. in the world at all. I'm not an isolationist.
We didn't intervene in Kosovo for oil. I mean, we intervene. I know and I think the documentary record shows it too. We intervened in Kosovo because we had basically been we had not intervened in Rwanda. We had not acted with anything like the firmness and speed we should have acted in when he first started doing what he was doing in Croatia and Bosnia. And finally, and I would say belatedly, we realized that he had to be stopped before he went into another country. I don't disagree with you that there are other strategies, and I would like a world in which we've got strategies and collective strategies that mean we don't have to resort to bombs. But given the situation we found ourselves in, I still think that was the lesser of two evils.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and then we're going to go on to another listener on line two in Urbana. Line two, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I would have to disagree with you about the fundamental problem in Iraq being one of execution. Admittedly, it was abysmal. But I think the documentary evidence is quite clear. The purpose was certainly not to create a democracy or even to do remove a very vile despot, but to seize the oil. And have you read Friedman's article in the Atlantic Monthly from the summer before the invasion?
I have not, although I... Well, go ahead and explain.
I think it makes clear that Friedman and the other neocons, and Pearl was one of those, and there were several others in the administration, were advocating a new empire. In fact, Pearl, I believe, or maybe it was... Wolfowitz, was praising the 2nd century Roman Empire as a model and the late British Empire in India as models for the United States. I think it's quite clear they had their eyes on the oil and world domination through military intervention, and the claims that they were doing it to create a democracy was disingenuous at best.
Well, I think there are multiple reasons why different people in the administration wanted to go to war. And what I don't disagree with is that what the record shows now is that there were many different reasons that people wanted to go into Iraq. And many of them, indeed, I would say most of them, were simply unjustifiable. I mean, I think oil did play a role. I think revenge played a role for finishing the job that was not done in 1991. I think the factor that you didn't list that was very important was a belief or recognition that after 9/11, Saudi Arabia could not be trusted in the way we thought it could be, that we needed to get our bases out of Saudi Arabia, and thus we needed another country in the Middle East that was friendly to us and that was a real power, and that Iraq would be that power. And, of course, we have moved our troops out of Saudi Arabia. They're in Qatar, and it's a very open secret that many members of the administration assumed we'd have long-term bases in Iraq. Alongside that, other people thought, well, we could democratize Iraq, and that would be the long-term way to fight terrorism. I think a lot of those motives were there side by side. For Rumsfeld, it didn't have to do with any of that. It had to do with proving that his revolution in military affairs, his smaller number of troops, could work. And from my point of view, I think many people did believe there were weapons of mass destruction. I talked to my friends who'd been in the Clinton administration, all of whom said, yes, on this issue, we saw evidence also that there were weapons of mass destruction. Your overall point is well taken. I don't think the fault was only in the execution. I think the fault was absolutely in the decision to go to war. At the time, I thought it was absolutely wrong in terms of the way we went to war. I was much more equivocal on the decision to go to war because I thought there were weapons of mass destruction there. But in retrospect, I think you're right.
Now you may, because she just finished. Go ahead.
Okay. I don't know how anyone could believe there were quantities of weapons of mass destruction. The UN had investigators there. And our own investigator, Scott Ritter, among others, said there were none in anything but negligible numbers.
But if you recall, there was a unanimous UN resolution in November of 2002, and Hans Blix himself was still holding open the likelihood that there were weapons. It is true that his second sweep in February of 2003, he said, look, we really don't have the evidence. We need more time. And at that point, we should have said, yes, we need more time, and we should have sent in more inspectors, and then in the end, we wouldn't have gone to war. And at that point, I agree with you. What became clear then, and many of us regret our own naivete, was that the forces in the administration had decided they were going to invade. They were going to invade in early March, regardless of what they found. And I agree with you that they were going to invade for a lot of other reasons that were completely unjustifiable.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana on line 3. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having the show. And I want to make just one comment, and then I'm going to hang up. I don't remember the show, unfortunately. I would rather be resourced better than this, but it was on the station where a fellow was being interviewed within the last 2 weeks, who talked about one of the polls that was done in Iraq of the soldiers in Iraq, and sort of as a go-along with what your guest had said a little bit ago, that the soldiers there think they are fighting for the red, white, and blue and to stop Al-Qaeda or whatever. And in a really sick sense, that is true. It was something like 80% of the soldiers that were interviewed thought that Saddam Hussein had attacked the Twin Towers. They're completely misinformed with the rhetoric that the administration has been pushing for the last 4 years, and they really don't have a clue why they're there. And that, I think, is very sad, and I think it's not okay when that type of information is available publicly for someone in government, including President Bush and his allies, or otherwise, to represent that the troops, in fact, think that they know why they're there. That's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Okay.
I think it's... I would agree with the comment, and that the entire misinformation that this was really about driving out terrorists, that this was the war on terror, that this was behind 9/11 is inexcusable, and particularly when lives are on the line.
Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine is Anne Marie Slaughter. She is the dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, the author most recently of The Idea That Is America, Keeping Faith with Our Values in a Dangerous World. The values that our guests say define America: liberty, democracy, equality, justice, tolerance, humility, and faith. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. One of the chapters that I found really interesting, and because we're so short on time here this afternoon, there's so much that we could talk about, is the chapter on justice. You write in this chapter, one of the things you say is, injustice can destroy liberty as surely and swiftly as any tyrant can. Talk with us about where we stand today in keeping with this value, our value of justice.
Well, I think there are two key ways to approach it, and in both cases, our value is under assault. And one is the way we are treating detainees in Guantanamo and anyone accused of being an illegal combatant, e.g. a terrorist, whether they're American or foreign. Effectively, the administration has declared they simply have no rights. They have no rights. This is such a fundamental violation of all the principles that this country was founded on. And we, you know, Americans, revolutionaries, people in the colonial period had the experience of of tyranny in which you could be detained without justification, in which you did not have the right to demand that you be tried. And that you have a lawyer to defend you. If you go back to our Constitution, you know, a huge part of the Bill of Rights is exactly about how do you defend yourself against the power of the state. And we're in a situation now where the British Attorney General, you know, Britain, our closest ally in many ways, has looked at Guantanamo and said it's a legal black hole. And we cannot proclaim that we stand for justice in the world until we close Guantanamo and return to some system of rules governing both imprisonment and interrogation of terrorists. We may have to adapt those rules to the circumstances of the threat we face, and we should do that with other nations, but we have to have rules. We cannot just have it be up to the power of whoever is president. And the second place I think justice destroys liberty, injustice destroys liberty, is social justice. We are seeing a situation in this country where the divide between the rich and the poor is growing extremely fast. We're really back to a social structure that looks like the Gilded Age of the late 19th century with the robber barons, in which an entire class of Americans can't get the health care or the education they need to even get a fair shot at a decent life. And justice has many definitions, but probably the most fundamental definition is justice is fairness. And when you get to a point where your society is structurally unfair, that people by accident of birth simply don't have a shot at a decent life, that corrodes the basis of our politics and can ultimately destroy our liberty.
Let's take another call. A listener, I believe, let me see here, in Indiana, in Brazil, Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hi. I do get your emails, and I find them very interesting, and I really want to thank you for all the work that you do. We need more thinkers and wise decision makers. Iraq is a big mess, and that is mostly due to what George Bush and the administration there has done. I want to make a comment, and then I have a question. I need to address an earlier caller. I've been somewhat involved in the Stop the War in Iraq group here in Terre Haute, and I don't know a single person in that group who is anti-military or anti-soldier. We spend our time and money to try to end an unjust war. And the person called and said that, you know, the bunch of liberals are very anti-war, anti-military. That is absolutely not the truth. People like myself, my brother was there, people like myself are willing to spend time and energy to get these people back. My brother, who's a teacher, 42 years old, was sent to Iraq. He got back in May. He's doing fine. But he should have been teaching children to read. That's what he does for a living. And now he's back. His life is, he's got a full-time job again, and he just bought a house. Things are going great for him. But he lost several good friends, and the war is unjust. And I got to say, I am really tired of people saying they support the war, and the only thing they do is put that ribbon on their car. I want to ask that caller, have they written letters? Have they sent packages? Have they sent monies to families that have lost wives, sons, daughters, and husbands? That's something that I'm a liberal. That's something I have done with my club at, I'm a teacher, my club at school, family members, all kinds of friends, the Stop the War in Iraq group. We've done that. What have you done to really support the soldiers there, all the men and women? And then I have a question.
Okay, go ahead with your question.
My question is this. I'm real curious about what's going on with the construction of the huge U.S. embassy in Iraq. We heard it in the news a little bit, and then it just sort of disappeared. I'm real skeptical and curious and interested if you know anything more about that. And I'm going to hang up and listen on the radio, okay? Thank you very much. I appreciate everything you do. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your first comment. I do think it is true that, very much unlike the Vietnam War, where the soldiers bore the brunt of public opposition to the war, the vast majority of Americans can distinguish, not all, as we heard from the first caller, can distinguish between those who've been ordered to fight and those who ordered them to fight. And it's those who ordered them to fight that bear the responsibility. But on your question about the embassy, I don't know much about the embassy except that, you know, I think it has been the administration's understanding that when the troops left, we would still need tremendous, a lot of civilian assistance for Iraqis if the Iraq government wanted it. So the large embassy was to accommodate the financial help, help on in building a justice system, all the different parts of the government that I think the administration has assumed would still need not only U.S. help, but help from other countries. I think more recently, of course, the Green Zone has been under attack. The security, even at the heart of Baghdad, has gotten worse. And so I don't know if either we're revising our plans as I suspect, the security situation is so bad we're simply not able to pursue construction.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line 2. Hi. Caller there? Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line 3.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm interested a lot in these notions of values that you're talking about, and I was wondering, because you just gave a few examples a few minutes ago of places or instances where values seem to have fallen short. I was wondering if you could comment on the realness of values, because they seem to be, in a lot of ways, very subjective and based in the locus of enunciation. Who's speaking the values, to whom, who they belong to, who do they apply to, who gets to decide values, who doesn't, to abide by them, and things like that. So I'll hang up. Thank you.
It's a great question, and it goes to, I think, the most fundamental debate about this book. My proposition is that there are a set of values that are not American values initially. They're Enlightenment values. They are the values of the 18th century Enlightenment that turned from religion to humanism to the belief that all human beings, by virtue of their humanity, both valued these things. They valued liberty, enough freedom to live their lives as they chose. They valued democracy, the right to govern themselves as they chose. They valued justice, the fairness and the rule of law. They valued equality. They valued those are Enlightenment values, and tolerance and humility and faith, I think, are the prerequisites in many ways to create a government based on those values. You know, you can't have a democracy without tolerance. I don't think you can have any of those without a dose of humility. And the Enlightenment was itself built on a faith in mankind that often coexists with a faith in a particular God. And what I'm arguing is those were the principles, the values that this country was founded on. And there, of course, you can interpret them differently at different times in our history. I mean, when we were talking about all men were created equal, there was slavery in this country. And when we were talking about democracy, actually, our founders weren't talking about democracy. They were talking about the franchise for white men with property. So obviously, the meaning of those values changes. It changes over time, and our definition of what justice is or equality is differs in many ways from what you would find in other liberal democracies like England or Japan or South Africa. Nevertheless, there's enough of a common core and it's a core across time and across cultures, that it defines the countries that actually aspire to a measure of these values, a measure of equality, a measure of liberty, a measure of justice, in ways that can have been and should continue to be the guides for our policy. And the proof, I think, is that major change in this country has almost always happened when some group of citizens, whether it was slaves and abolitionists, whether it was women, whether it was any other minority, stood up and said, "You're promising equality. We have no equality. You're treating us like second-class citizens. You're promising justice. You are not giving us justice. The system is rigged against us, or that you're violating the rule of law. You are promising us democracy, but we don't have the right to vote." That's the sense in which I think there is a kind of a transcendental core of these values that has guided us and needs to guide us again, and guides other countries that have political systems based on achieving, as I said, what are really universal values.
Mm. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. I was very fortunate as a child, and I think maybe a number of the same way, is that I was fortunate to have parents who had strong values. And the one that really concerns me a great deal is honesty. If we just started from honesty, I mean, our Congress, our politicians, you know, really are not good role models. We have earmarking, we have, you know, the special interest groups and all that. And I'll go off the air and I'll let you comment if you like.
Okay.
Should we
put honesty on your list?
Oh, it's that is great, and I've gotten that question before. You know, what about honesty? And I absolutely agree. I think if you read my chapter on humility, you'll see that's in many ways what I'm talking about. My definition of humility is having the honesty and the character to recognize that you don't know everything and you are not infallible, that you have things to learn from others, that you make mistakes, and when you make mistakes, and this is where the honesty comes in, you are honest about it and you accept responsibility. And I point out that Americans are characterized, at least in the eyes of other countries, because of our tremendous belief in progress. Well, you can't believe in progress if you think you're already perfect. And indeed, many of our greatest figures, if you look at Washington or Lincoln, or any of our great religious figures who are often deeply humble in the face of their God, what goes hand in hand with that is a very unflinching, honest assessment of where their strengths, but also their faults, and a willingness to then stand up and say, "All right, I've made a mistake," or "I don't know everything," and I either shoulder responsibility or I ask for help.
Let's get one more call in this afternoon, but we'll have to kind of keep a rein here, rein things in a little bit. Line four. Listener in Charleston, hello.
Thank you, yes. It seems to me, and I'm not sure exactly what the origin of the values, how do you know what these values were, but I suspect that they are supposed to describe the population generally of the United States. And I wonder, and you talk with sometimes people overseas, that, well, you're fine, we like Americans, but we don't like your government or its policies. Haven't we got a basic problem without a solution yet, as the government does not adequately, or does not really, intentionally or not, does not represent the values of the society as you would describe them? And what the problem is there. This is, I was just rereading, if you may be familiar with a book by former Senator J. William Fulbright, The Arrogance of Power.
Yes.
And we're at the point where we are now even stronger than we were in 1966, and we do things because we can. And when it comes to it, we say that, well, we are going to do whatever is necessary to defend our, quote, vital national interests. And the values, I don't believe, are those. They tend to be more material things. And this is very upsetting, especially with what I see as the militarization of practically everything, including, unfortunately, diplomacy.
Well, I'd have to urge you to buy my book to find the full answer to that question, but I think I can give a one-sentence answer in light of our time constraints. A very distinguished German newspaper editor who's a friend of mine says that beneath every America hater is a disappointed America lover. And what he means by that is that people around the world like our values, but they expect us to live up to them. And when we betray them as clearly as we have right now, and we never live up to them perfectly, don't, and we, of course, are also a materialist, self-interested power, but when we clearly betray them, we not only let ourselves down, we let other people in other countries down, and in ways that mean they reject our government, but they increasingly also reject us for not standing up and saying to our government, enough.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Anne-Marie Slaughter, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a great discussion.
Anne-Marie Slaughter, the author most recently of The Idea That Is America, Keeping Faith with Our Values in a Dangerous World. The book is published by Basic Books. Our guest, Anne-Marie Slaughter, Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. You can find out more about our guest and the book at the website www.ideathatisamerica.com.